night.
I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. Well, more turmoil in the newsroom of the New York Times today. The two top editors at the nation's top newspaper resigned in the wake of a scandal that's placed the paper under unprecedented scrutiny and its editors under unprecedented criticism. Executive editor Howell Raines and managing editor Gerald Boyd stepped down following revelations last month that reporter Jason Blair had fabricated stories and sources and consistently lied about his whereabouts. New York Times publisher Arthur Sulzberger told Times staffers at a morning meeting that this is a day that breaks my heart. Joseph Lelyveld, who used to have Raines' job, has been named interim executive editor. And now joining us to discuss this breaking story is Bob Steele. Bob's director of ethics at the Poynter Institute. He joins us from St. Petersburg, Florida. Bob, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Bob, you know, not everyone reads the New York Times, but it is the paper of record. It sets the agenda for an amazing number of other news media in our country. At the same time, I don't know anyone who's stopped reading the paper. It seemed to be getting back on its feet. Why the resignations now?
Well, this is the Mount St. Helens of journalism, a big-time earthquake, and what has transpired in recent weeks since the Jason Blair episode surfaced is that there were many faults within the New York Times system. What allowed Jason Blair to steal and lie and cheat to the degree he did was system failure there. The top editors didn't have their hand on the tiller. They were not guiding the boat in the way in which they should have been. They didn't pay attention to some very serious warnings about Jason Blair's behavior, and they, in essence, needed to be held accountable. It looked like they were going to weather the storm, but there were also other incidents within the last couple of weeks. Another Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, Rick Bragg, was suspended for fudging on a dateline, and he resigned, and it was clear that Boyd and Raines were shaking in their tenure there, and apparently they decided they couldn't lead the New York Times anymore. At the same time, the New York Times remains a very good newspaper, one of the best in the world, but their credibility has been rocked.
You know, we all have friends and colleagues who work at the New York Times. It's not a notoriously happy shop to work in the best of times, is it?
Well, I think that's often true of the best of organizations, whether it's the New York Times or some of our other well-known newspapers or some of our top broadcast organizations. There can be a lot of turmoil within a culture, and that can apply within major industries and corporations as well. It puts a great premium on having leaders who not only have vision, who not only have the chutzpah to lead, but have the gravitas to lead the organization during difficult times, to make sure that principles and professionalism are honored, and that they create a culture in which there is a great deal of respect within the organization, a great deal of conversation, meaningful deliberation, and great deal of oversight on quality control.
Well, Bob, speaking about all of that, how you got to give Raines credit for one thing, and he came on as an executive editor in the days after the September or just before the September 11th attacks. Well, the paper went on to win 6 Pulitzer Prizes for its coverage of the attacks and the war in Afghanistan. Why was that enough for him to hold on?
Well, Howell Raines is a terrific journalist. He's proved that in many ways over the years. Gerald Boyd is a great journalist. The New York Times was excellent in its coverage after 9/11, and it covers the news of this country and the world like no other newspaper or news organization. But what seemed to be the case is that there was a serious tear in the fabric of the culture of the New York Times organization.
And a lack of trust. A lack of trust.
Well, certainly a lack of trust was part of it, that the staff apparently, at least in large enough number, were not confident that Raines and Boyd could lead the paper, given what had happened. And Sulzberger, the publisher, Arthur Sulzberger, must have also believed that was the case in order to accept their resignations. He was a strong supporter of Raines and Boyd. He, of course, had chosen Howell Raines as his top editor over some other top candidates. And he had a lot at stake in making sure that Raines weathered the storm. Howell Raines did not weather the storm. His handpicked number two editor, Gerald Boyd, did not weather the storm, and it makes Arthur Sulzberger's job as the publisher even more difficult.
Bob Steele, thanks very much for joining us on short notice on this breaking story.
Well, my pleasure. It's a sad day for us in journalism, but we have to figure out how to right the ship and move ahead.
Still a great newspaper. Bob Steele, director of ethics at the Poynter Institute. He joins us from St. Petersburg, Florida. Well, Turning now to tax cuts, when President Bush signed the third tax cut in 3 years into law last week, it didn't contain a provision that would give a tax break of $400 per child to millions of poor families. The child tax credit was dropped at the last minute by cost-cutting lawmakers. It didn't make big headlines, but House Majority Leader Tom DeLay did this week when he said there were more important things to do than try to restore the tax credit to families that don't even pay income tax, he said. Well, Democrats pounced, firing out a press release entitled "Let Them Eat Cake," comparing DeLay to Marie Antoinette. The end result? Today there's word nervous politicians are trying to reach a compromise on all this. Katie Stimmel is a reporter for the Bureau of National Affairs, which publishes the Daily Tax Report, and she joins us from Capitol Hill. Katie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
$400 per child, that can mean a lot to a family with five kids. So what's in the compromise and who's behind it?
There are a number of people behind the compromise, and what the senators are trying to do is strike a middle ground between two different proposals. Senators Blanche Lincoln and Olympia Snowe, they have the one proposal out, and then there's a broader proposal that was offered by Senate Finance Committee Chairman Grassley.
He wants to not only extend the child tax credit back to poor people who weren't going to get it, but he wants to extend it to people who make more than $100,000 too, right?
That's correct. Under current law, if you're a single head of household, you can earn up to $75,000 before the credit begins to phase out. And then for married couples who file joint returns, that phase-out level is $110,000. What he wants to do is take that level up to $150,000, so it would be equal twice that income level provided for a single filer.
So if you made more than $150,000 under Senator Grassley's plan, you wouldn't get the per-child tax cut.
Right. That would be the phase-out level.
So, Katie, how likely is it that people who now are not scheduled to receive that $400 tax cut, after some more compromise, some new bills, will be able to get their tax cut?
It really depends on what happens in the House. It appears likely that the Senate will consider a bill addressing this issue as early as today. It appears that Senator Lincoln and Senator Snowe have enough votes that their proposal would likely get through the Senate. What is less clear is what would happen in the House. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay had mentioned that he would be willing to consider this measure, but only in the context of a broader tax cut bill. If that happens, there could be a big political fight over it. So it would be, you know, it's not that clear what would happen in the House.
Now, all of this talk is about cutting more taxes. Doesn't that create larger deficits?
Well, that has been a concern of a number of, expressed by a number of Democrats. Senators Lincoln and Snowe, they would seek to pay for their bill through putting curbs on abusive tax shelters that were brought to light in a congressional study on the collapse of the Enron Corporation.
Hmm. The $64,000 question, Katie, is this going to pass? Are these new bills going to pass?
It looks like some sort of bill could very well pass in the Senate as early as today. And then the situation in the House, I think it just, to a certain degree, depends on how the politics play out.
Katie Stimmel, thank you very much for taking some time and talking to us about all this.
You're welcome.
Katie Stimmel is a reporter for the Bureau of National Affairs, which publishes the Daily Tax Report. Still very much up in the air today, the ongoing story of weapons of mass destruction and what happened to them. The Bush administration and the Blair government in London insist that one day soon WMD will be found in Iraq. But critics say the harder they look for WMD, the less credible Bush and Blair's pre-war claims seem. Claims that Saddam Hussein had large stores of weapons ready for offensive use. Well, in today's Washington Post, there are new details to the story. Walter Pincus covers national security for the paper and co-wrote today's article. Walter, welcome.
Happy to be here.
Thanks, Walter. The story keeps growing. Congressional hearings, internal investigations, government inquiries in Britain. Your story today adds an interesting detail involving Vice President Cheney. Tell us about it.
Well, in a very unusual series of events, the vice president and his chief of staff, Louis Libby, made multiple trips out to the CIA to personally sit down with analysts dealing with Iraq so that they could face-to-face talk to them and question them about their findings.
How unusual is that kind of a journey out to Langley?
It's very unusual for a vice president to do something like that. One of the reasons for him doing it, I'm told, is because he was on the Intelligence Committee and he has a particular interest in intelligence. The fact of the matter is that he and his office play an extremely active role in the national security and intelligence area within the administration. What makes it unusual, however, is that during the time he made most of these trips to question analysts, he had already gone on public record as focusing on Iraq in beginning in August of 2002 as a potential target and as a growing danger to the United States.
Now, isn't it in the brief of a vice president, nonetheless, particularly a vice president who has the president's ear as much as this one does, to find out about something as important as this?
Well, the vice president attends the president's normal daily briefing every morning, in which there is a special presidential daily brief in writing given the president with the new intelligence overnight, and a briefer from CIA there so that they could ask questions in that venue.
So he's got enough. Now, Walter, why are seemingly intelligence agents in the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency upset enough about this to talk to a reporter like you?
Well, some of the people are upset because they, and they not just talk to me, they've talked to people on the Hill. And so there's a concern that some of them feel this is a form of pressure being brought by the vice president just based on the questions he asked. But that's, you know, that's not everybody, and a lot of the senior analysts feel that it just shows the vice president has a greater interest, and it makes them feel that they're getting their information directly to the top government officials. Mm-hmm. They also make the point that the most senior one I've talked to, who is familiar with what's going on, is that it hasn't affected the analysts. They don't see that the analysts are changing their views. It's just some of them feel they're being pressured, and then they don't want to feel that pressure. They want to be able to sort of tell it like they see it without worrying.
Well, certainly an activist vice president. Walter Pincus, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Walter Pincus is a staff writer for The Washington Post. Just ahead, is Colombia's civil war going regional? And later in the show, baseball poetry from our listeners. There's more coming up here and now.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Delta Dental Plan of Massachusetts, encouraging listeners to see their dentist regularly. It's good for teeth and overall health. 1-800-DELTA-US. And Skinner Auctioneers, hosting an auction of antique American furniture, folk art, and paintings this Sunday, June 8th at 11 a.m. in Boston. Details and catalog at SkinnerInc.com. 60 degrees and cloudy in Boston. This is WBUR. Peter Gabriel tickets are available now at the WBUR online auction. I hear that voice again. See award-winning artist Peter Gabriel in a rare live performance at the Tweeter Center on June 18th. This pair of tickets is just one of the hundreds of items you can bid on in the WBUR online auction going on right now. Go to WBUR.org and make a bid for the news.
I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. Well, the war in Iraq lasted 3 weeks or so. World War II lasted 5 years or so. and the civil war in Colombia has smoldered now for 39 years. And some fear that never before has the Colombian war threatened more dangerously to spill over its borders. In a recent story in the New York Times, reporter Juan Forero writes that war in Colombia is spilling leftist rebels, right-wing death squads, drugs, and refugees into Ecuador, Panama, and especially neighboring Venezuela. Forero is based in Colombia, and he joins us now from Bogota. Welcome, Juan.
Thank you.
Well, Juan, thanks for joining us, Juan. First off, 39 years. Remind us very briefly what ignited the war and why the country's still burning, if you will.
Well, the country's conflict actually goes back even further. When we talk about 39 years, we're talking about the age of the two rebel groups that have been waging war against the government. But the war actually has roots in the 1950s when there was a conflict between the Liberal Party and the Conservative Party here that killed hundreds of thousands of people.
Right. Essentially boiled down, in, at least for the past 39 years, rich against poor.
In the 1960s and the 1970s, yes, you could say that it was a war of the poor against the government and against the elite. But it's changed really in the last decade, and it has had more to do with drugs. Drugs fuel this conflict, and many folks here in Colombia say that now the rebels have sort of lost their political north, if you will, and that they're heavily involved in drugs and crime, and that's what fuels them now.
That's what they're trying to protect. Well, Juan, you just traveled across the Colombian border into Venezuela. You encountered Colombian leftist rebels there. What did you see?
My plan had basically been to get there to see what had happened in the town and perhaps interview some folks who were still living there. But lo and behold, when I landed, there were Colombian guerrillas there. They had a makeshift camp, more than likely a very temporary camp. And I arrived there and began to speak with them and got an interview with their commander of a, you know, small squad, 10 or 12 guys.
Now, how concerned would the Venezuelan government of Hugo Chavez be about something like that?
Well, I think publicly very concerned because the government has the official line from President Chavez has been that they will chase all armed groups out of Venezuelan territory. That would include the rebels as well as the paramilitaries from Colombia.
Is there a possible scenario where the government of Hugo Chavez begins to support its fellow leftists among these rebels in Colombia and the whole war in Colombia widens even into Venezuela?
Well, that's the charge from the opposition. I haven't seen a smoking gun on that yet. I mean, one of I think the more plausible possibility is that there are pacts between corrupt Venezuelan military units and rebels. That is not something that is new. That had happened long before President Hugo Chavez took power.
Now, of course, there are U.S. troops in Colombia. Remind our audience how many and how might they be pulled into all this?
Well, the last time we checked, there were several dozen special forces troops in Arauca, which is a province just south of where I was, and it does border the Venezuelan border. And they were training Colombian troops in the art of guarding a oil pipeline, which happens to be run by an American company, Occidental Petroleum of Los Angeles. These are troops that are training Colombian forces in not only protecting the pipeline, but counterinsurgency warfare.
So this sounds like at this point some Colombian rebels in small numbers taking refuge in Venezuela along this enormous 1,400-mile border. This is not yet a conflagration that could extend between countries. This is just more of a 39-year-plus war in Colombia with no end in sight.
It is more of it, but it certainly is of deep concern right now in the region because I don't know that we're talking about just a few rebels. We could be talking about hundreds of rebels. The Colombian military says that there are camps in at least three Venezuelan states that border Colombia. And I also want to point out that there's also been evidence of Colombian guerrillas setting up camp in Ecuador and in Panama in particular. And they certainly cross over into Peru and into Brazil also. These are difficult, rugged borders along this entire region, jungles, mountains. They are difficult to patrol. When you think about it, it is when you hear President Hugo Chavez say that the borders are porous, you have to believe it once you go down there and you see these places. They are not easy to patrol.
All of which, of course, has an impact on the flourishing of the drug trade, which, as you pointed out at the beginning of our conversation, is what these so-called leftist rebels have really become about at this point.
Exactly. I mean, one of the problems is that the rebels are trying to find places to traffic drugs, to move drugs, and also also the folks who are involved in the harvesting, the planting of drugs are also moving more and more along the borders. One of the reasons for this is because the U.S. has put hundreds of millions of dollars into a very aggressive coca spraying campaign throughout Colombia. And I also want to point out that it isn't just the rebels, but the paramilitaries, who are a right-wing force. They are also heavily involved in cocaine trafficking to the United States. So it's a witch's brew of many different groups involved in drugs and involved in the conflict.
A witch's brew, and we won't start talking about the drug problems in South America because we'd be here for about a day and a half. Juan Forero, thank you very much for joining us from Bogota.
Thank you very much.
Juan Forero covers the Andean countries for the New York Times. He joined us from Bogota, Colombia. Tomorrow on Here and Now, new rules on media ownership. Could it change the paper that lands on your doorstep? Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Elephant Walk Restaurant in Boston, newly renovated and with a new spring menu, serving dinner nightly and lunch Monday through Friday, 900 Beacon Street, and online at elephantwalk.com. By the Boston Early Music Festival and Exhibition, June 9th through the 15th, presenting music of the German Baroque and the fully staged opera Ariadne. Tickets at bemf.org. And by Schneider Leasing Company, providing short-term computer rental services for conferences, conventions, and special events, 617-261-6060. Our next Citizens of the World Tour is going to Tuscany and Umbria this summer. Learn more about the trip at a free reception on Monday. You'll sample a tasting menu of traditional Tuscan foods and wines from Bistro 5 in West Medford. To reserve your space, call 800-909-9287. This is WBUR.
Ian Kerr, captain of the research vessel Odyssey.
You're on deck, and suddenly an 80-foot blue whale sidles up to the Odyssey. The whale rolls slightly. You make eye contact. Who's studying who?
Now is your chance to experience a 10-day voyage sailing among the great whales aboard the Odyssey on the WBUR online auction. Make a bid for the news.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Coming up, some Israelis say they'll fight for their settlements.
Those so-called illegal outposts are the first stage, and Ariel Sharon is about to continue. It's not the only stage is going to stop it. People in Israel are very, very worried about this process.
While Palestinians rebuild their homes without permission.
They're breaking the law through desperate need. The situation is that the government has designated virtually all the privately owned Palestinian land in and around Palestinian neighborhoods as green space or parkland.
Also, poems about baseball coming up Here and Now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. Two top editors at the New York Times have resigned in the wake of the Jason Blair reporting scandal. Executive editor Howell Raines and managing editor Gerald Boyd are leaving their posts. Joseph Lelyveld, a former executive editor of the Times, has been named interim executive editor. No interim managing editor has been named. Raines and Boyd had been criticized for overlooking numerous concerns about Jason Blair raised by others on the Times staff. President Bush is on his way back to Washington after his Mideast summit in a symbolic act. Air Force One made a detour, flying into Iraqi airspace and, escorted by four fighter jets, made a pass over Baghdad. Earlier, the president wrapped up his trip to the region with a speech to American troops at the U.S. Command Center in Qatar, praising them for a mission accomplished in Iraq. Meantime, one U.S. soldier was killed and five others wounded when an assailant fired a grenade at them at a checkpoint in the central Iraqi town of Fallujah. U.S. officials also say two other Americans were wounded in Baghdad today when they were fired on as they were guarding a bank. Yasser Arafat may no longer be at center stage, but some Palestinian officials say he's still in charge. They say he was directing new Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas every step of the way during this week's summit. Both Israel and the United States refuse to deal with Arafat anymore. Attorney General John Ashcroft is facing tough criticism from his own agency's inspector general. Speaking before the House Judiciary Committee, Ashcroft said the Justice Department has not broken any laws treating aliens taken into custody after the September 11th attacks.
God forbid if we ever have to do this again, we hope that we can clear people more quickly. We'd like to clear people as quickly as possible. There's no interest whatsoever that the United States of America has in holding innocent people. Absolutely none. It's costly.
The Justice Department's Inspector General found significant problems in the handling of 762 foreigners held on immigration violations after 9/11. Chicago club slugger Sammy Sosa meets with baseball disciplinarian Bob Watson today to discuss a possible suspension over cork found in one of Sosa's bats. Meanwhile, an X-ray examination found no cork in Sosa's other bats. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is down 17 points at 90.21. The Nasdaq is off 2 points at 16.33. 33 minutes past the hour, you're listening to Here and Now. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Gregorian Oriental Rugs, hosting a shopping event now through June 8th, featuring hand-woven, individually designed rugs from Tibet. Gregorian, a little part of Persia in Newton Lower Falls. By Surface Works of Watertown and Concord, a professional cleaning service, because it's nice to come home to a clean house, 617-926-7633. And by the Capitol Steps, performing their newest political musical satire at the Copley Theater, June 17th through the 22nd. Tickets on sale now through Ticketmaster and Bostik's CapitalSteps.com. In the forecast, cloudy and a chance of showers this afternoon, highs around 62. A chance of showers tonight with lows in the 50s, and tomorrow gradually clearing and warmer, getting into the 70s. 60 degrees right now in Boston. In sports, the Red Sox shoot for a sweep of their three-game series against the Pirates. In Pittsburgh, John Burkett gets the start for the Sox. This is WBUR.
I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. Thousands of Israeli settlers rallied in Jerusalem late last night after one of their staunchest defenders, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, promised to trade away some small new settlements in return for peace and end to Palestinian terror. While some settlers denounce any politician who would give an inch, others see the writing on the wall and are doing some writing of their own. A group of settler leaders is drawing up a plan that would make some concessions, partitioning the West Bank but keeping most settlements intact. Shaul Goldstein is the mayor of the Gush Etzion settlement east of Jerusalem. He joins us now from Gush Etzion. Welcome, Mr. Goldstein.
Welcome to everybody.
Now, you helped organize last night's rally, and, you know, you even spoke in defense of all settlements, yet you're also drawing up a partition plan that could close some settlements. So what's going on here? Are you just trying to cover all eventualities?
No. First of all, this is not a partition plan. You have to understand. We think that we're entitled to have the entire land. This is the home of the Jewish land. It's the cradle of Judaism, and it's nobody's land besides the Jewish people. Second, we recognize that the Arabs living here should have civil rights, should have municipalities, should have all the infrastructure, as anyone else in Israel, which is much, much beyond whatever they have in any Arab country. Combining those two issues, it's not dividing the area, but rather giving them some municipalities, some self-autonomy.
But could your partition plan lead to closing some settlements?
Not at all. I don't think it's reasonable to ask Jews not to live in Judea. We are eager to have coexistence with them. The problem is that we're suffering so much from terror, so today the fate is very minimal.
What will happen if Prime Minister Ariel Sharon begins to dismantle, even soon, some of the far-flung settlements built since March 2001?
If he's going to dismantle what he calls unauthorized or illegal places, we think we are law obedient and we have to commit to the law. If they go to court, okay, and we will join you, we'll cooperate because we don't want to do anything illegal. But if he's trying to dismantle places that are legally established and authorized, I think we will fight him as much as we can in the borders of democracy.
So, Mr. Goldstein, the rally last night, tens of thousands of settlers, was not so much about the possibility of removing some scattered trailers on bare hillsides built since March 2001, but it was concern about other settlements well beyond those so-called illegal settlements eventually being dismantled. That's what that rally was about.
Yeah, it was against the whole process. I think you're absolutely right. Those so-called illegal outposts are the first stage, and Ariel Sharon is about to continue. It's not the only stage he's going to stop it. People in Israel are very, very worried about this process. Even in the left side, you can hear votes and notes that are totally against this plan. People think that this plan is a disaster to Israel, worse, much worse than the Oslo Accord. And this is not only from the right-wing politics.
Do you believe you will ever see Ariel Sharon, always one of the greatest defenders, if not founders, of the settler movement, do you ever believe he will dismantle so-called legal settlements?
I hope not.
Shaul Goldstein, we want to thank you very much for joining us on Here and Now.
Thank you, and have a great day.
Shaul Goldstein is the mayor of the Gush Etzion settlement in the West Bank. Now, as some Israeli settlers continue the fight to keep their homes, many Palestinian families have faint hopes of getting their homes back. Israeli officials have demolished numerous Palestinian homes, sometimes in reprisal against the families of suspected suicide bombers, but far more often in what are called administrative demolitions, the destruction of homes because they lack building permits. There are no precise figures, but most estimates put the numbers of such demolitions in the thousands. The UN says more than 12,000 people have been made homeless in the past 3 years alone. Now a new group is raising money to rebuild some of those dwellings. The Global Campaign to Rebuild Palestinian Homes is a coalition of American, Palestinian, and Israeli groups. And from northern Israel, we're joined now by Fred Shlomka, from one of the groups, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Hello, Fred.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
What is an administrative demolition?
An administrative demolition is a demolition of a home that has been built without a building permit. That's the usual motive to demolish.
Now, Fred, why would a Palestinian build a home without a building permit? It's not the sort of thing you would do anywhere.
That's correct. There are virtually no building permits in Jerusalem today available. The government has designated virtually all the privately owned Palestinian land in and around Palestinian neighborhoods and villages as green space or parkland.
So the Palestinians are breaking the law.
That's correct. They're breaking the law through need, through desperate need. The situation in many communities is that there's often two or three brothers and their wives, perhaps 30 children, living in a tiny home. And they own land, often on an adjacent property. Their land has often been in their family for generations. The government has said, well, this is parkland or this is agricultural space, despite the fact that often it's in the middle of a village. And so they often will apply for building permits, and they'll go through a process of a year or more, and at the end of the process, they'll be told there is no building permit. So out of desperate need, the Palestinians build homes.
Doesn't the municipality of Jerusalem have the right to say, like any municipality, who can build a home where They say someone can build a home.
That's correct. However, the municipal government of Jerusalem generally plans the expansion of the city for the benefit of the Jewish residents. There are thousands of homes being built with government subsidies throughout the east of Jerusalem, surrounding the Palestinian neighborhoods.
How many homes have you been able to rebuild?
Over the last 5 years, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions has rebuilt 10 homes. During the last year, with the help of the Global Campaign to Rebuild Palestinian Homes, we have completed 4 homes and are working on a 5th.
And those homes are still standing?
One of them was demolished. The home of the Shawamri family in East Jerusalem was demolished for the 4th time about 3 months ago.
Where does your money come from, Fred, to build these homes?
We collect the money from thousands of people in Europe and North America who hold events in their homes, house parties. It's basically on the Tupperware principle. People sign up to have an event. We send them a video, supporting materials. They invite friends and colleagues to their homes. Most of the support comes in the form of $10, $20, $30 checks.
Fred, why are you, as an Israeli, getting involved in this?
I am shocked and disgusted at my government's policies towards the minority populations here, especially in the West Bank. We rebuild homes primarily as a gesture of solidarity with our Palestinian friends and as a gesture of resistance against our government policies. We call it constructive resistance to the occupation.
Fred Shlomka, thank you very much for joining Here and Now.
Thank you.
Fred Shlomka is with the Committee Against House Demolitions, part of the global campaign to rebuild Palestinian homes. For more, visit our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. It's Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. The most email was generated by our interview with Joseph Shammi, director of the Population Division at the United Nations. Mr. Shammi claims that shrinking populations in wealthier countries could threaten the balance of power around the globe. Now, Robin Young called listener David Estale of Ashland, Massachusetts, to ask about his concerns.
On our present course, increasing populations will significantly impact the ecosystems and ecosystems in every single country.
Right. As you write, natural ecosystems are collapsing as a result of present population pressures.
Yes.
Well, David, we hear your concerns, and I want to say for the record, I want to acknowledge my bad, which was that we had a line in the introduction to the piece that I removed for time that acknowledged that overpopulation is, of course, as big a problem as underpopulation. So my apologies.
Well, thank you very much, Robin.
Well, last week's segment on Florida's move to hold back third graders who do not pass the FCAT, or Florida's Comprehensive Assessment Test, drew this response from listener Yaakov Finkelman of Brookline, Massachusetts. I am seriously dyslexic and would not have passed the third grade FCAT even in the middle of high school. But despite this, I have managed just fine because I didn't let it stop me. If third graders can't learn to read after 4 years of trying, we should help them learn without reading, and in their time, they may also learn to read. Now, food guru Scott Haas's piece yesterday on the Swiss air-dried beef known as Buntnerfleisch drew this response on our listener line from Sydney Haig of Milton, Massachusetts.
The person during the segment used words such as beautiful and passionate. And what was he describing? He was describing corpses of animals, flesh. Where are the voices of vegetarians?
Well, maybe we just heard one. Paul Marsh of Weir, New Hampshire, had his own beef with our interview with the editor of Non-Campus Mentis, a collection of the humorous errors made by college students writing papers. Mr. Marsh took issue with one of the reported goofs. The book poked fun at a student who described the big three of World War II as Stalin, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Truman. He writes, "Since there were three nations fighting the war as allies, there were three heads of state as their representatives. Since Truman became a member of those three heads of state only upon the death of Roosevelt, the big three would seem to be correct." Point taken, Mr. Marsh. Hopefully the student didn't have too many points taken off for that answer. And finally, we received this email from Amy Catherine Dragoo of Coatesville, Pennsylvania, about our piece on a horse stable in Manhattan. I was driving down a peaceful country road, watching the horses and listening to your piece on the Claremont Riding Academy, when Back in the Saddle Again began playing. For some reason, this began the tears of laughter, only to have them increase tenfold with the wobbly rollerblader comment. Thank you so much for starting my day out on the right hoof. You're welcome, and it behooves you to contact us. We love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your name, phone number, and town where you live. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by PIMSLR Direct Language Programs, featuring over 35 languages. 30% of each purchase goes to help pay for the news on WBUR, available at the public radio store at WBUR.org. By the Boston Early Music Festival and Exhibition, June 9th through the 15th, presenting music of the German Baroque and the fully staged opera Ariadne. Tickets at BEMF.org. And by Mississippi's. Mississippi's opened in Kenmore Square in 1977, moved to Brigham Circle in 1986, and found a permanent home at Roxbury Crossing in 1998. The WBUR online auction is underway. Your chance to bid on hundreds of items, including lunch for two with Boston University President Dr. John Silber. Go to WBUR.org and make a bid for the news. 60 degrees now. News from the BBC is ahead at 1.
I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. It's that time of the year when hordes of Americans, young, old, and in between, make their way to local fields to spend a leisurely day taking in the great American pastime. And my co-host, Robin Young, is one of the game's biggest fans.
Nine players on the field, the restless rustle of the crowd, the swish and crack of the ball meeting the bat, the wafting aroma of popcorn, peanuts, and Cracker Jacks, the moans from the crowd, the tears. Oh, wait, that's me because I'm a Red Sox fan. But otherwise, these images all say baseball. And here now is roving poets Jim Burley and Molly Sicardo are back in the studio to invite listeners to step up to the plate and share your poetic reveries about the great American sport. This is the Ladies' Poetry Challenge, and welcome back, Jim and Molly.
Hello, Robin.
I can almost smell the Fenway Franks, Robin.
Well, good
as
thing.
As long as you don't taste
right.
them.
Or smell other things at that old and beloved park. But, Jim, this was your idea, of course.
I'm obsessed with baseball. I wish I could put a finger on why. It's just everything about baseball fascinates me. Even like in the deadest of winter, I'm reading about baseball every day and hoping that this will be the year.
That the Red Sox will win. But let's put that aside. You're not the only one, though, because there is poetry, so much poetry written about baseball.
Oh, there's a ton of stuff, and especially over the years from a variety of different voices. I have one of my favorite poems is one by Gregory Corso, which I've read before.
Mm-hmm.
It's about Ted Williams. It's called Dream of a Baseball Star. I just want to read the last stanza, which is one of my favorites. And it's building up, and he's talking about this dream that he has of Ted Williams at the Eiffel Tower. And I screamed in my dream, God, throw thy merciful pitch. Herald the crack of bats. Hooray the sharp liner to left. Yea, the double, the triple. Hosanna, the home run. Just so overjoyed. And
you shared that poem when the Splendid Splinter passed away recently.
I believe so. It was when we had Dream Poems, too, maybe.
Right.
I'm an echo.
Well, we can't hear it enough. Molly, and this isn't just gender specific.
No, it isn't. Baseball poetry, I love baseball, too. I'm not quite into it as Jim is, but I do love baseball. And the thing that's neat about the baseball poetry as you start to research it is that people do mention specific players or moments. And it's a history. It's a history lesson. Ogden Nash, the poet best known for his funny limericks, did an ABC poem, and I'll read just part of it. G is for Gehrig, the pride of the stadium, his record pure gold, his courage pure radium. H is for Hornsby, when pitching to Raj, the pitcher would pitch, then the pitcher would dodge.
Well, it's also funny that people a lot of times will write about what's not happening on the field. One of my favorite baseball poems is by William Carlos Williams, a great poet, who wrote this poem, At the Ball Game. The crowd at the ball game is moved uniformly by a spirit of uselessness which delights them. all the exciting detail of the chase and the escape, the era, the flash of genius, all to no end save beauty, the eternal. So in detail they, the crowd, are beautiful. For this to be warned against, saluted and defied, it is alive, venomous, it smiles grimly, its words cut. The flashy female with her mother gets it. The Jew gets it straight. It is deadly, terrifying. It is the Inquisition, the revolution. It is beauty itself that lives day by day in them idly. This is the power of their faces. It is summer. It is the solstice. The crowd is cheering. The crowd is laughing in detail, permanently, seriously, without thought.
For crying out loud, it's baseball.
No, it's about everything.
you remind me in saying that, you know, you might write about what's not happening on the field. I'm sure we have listeners who are saying, nothing's ever happening on the field. I mean, so if you hate baseball as well, I mean, you could put that to poem. But I know you've both composed your own baseball poems out of love. Molly, why don't you go first?
Okay. Mine is called Baseball Poets. Coach has Longfellow batting cleanup. Because of his name, he gets pegged as a power hitter. Wadsworth is all right, but Walt Whitman belongs in that spot. He sends the ball right out of the park and into America large. Now Poe, when he gets on, he runs those bases with the tintinnabulation of a tiger, tiger, tiger paws clawing straight out of hell. He plays a hot shortstop, too. When he grabs a line drive and fires off at the double play to Sandberg at first, well, that's poetry. One afternoon, they pulled the 6-3 off to save the game for Frost. He was tiring and just couldn't get that high heat over. That play gave Robbie the fire to come back in the ninth to take them down with his curve. The umpire called every batter, out, out, you're out. All on the pitch not taken.
Oh. Wow.
Okay, Jim.
It's so good, I wish it was mine.
You can have it. There
Just
you go.
Tap your bat against your shoes, get the dust off,
well,
step up.
I think this is well titled. It's called Bach. So much depends upon hitting the cutoff man before shadows creep and hold the diamond. A shot with just enough pop to splash the pool in the bob. Oasis meet Arizona desert valley. In rusties, dusties, and chippers we trust. Their eye black, a sparkle in the wonderful drag of mid-afternoon. Hooray for the howling booze lifting from the cheap seats like the highest tide to sweep away the thunderstruck pitcher. Hooray even for the goats, you who miss signs, who bobble, who serve up lame fastballs and hanging curves that quack. Fathers and sons watching together, or sons thinking of fathers who once passed to them a heavy, dusty bat. Would I could write a line as clean as a fourth inning sinker, or joyous and sloppy as the wave, crassly filling a lull.
Yeah.
Oh, Jim.
Yeah.
Okay. You got it all in there.
I love the wave.
Three bases. Well, Jim, I'm thinking also that we got through all of this without ever once mentioning Casey.
Oh, Casey
at the bat.
How did we forget Casey?
I don't know. But
it was obvious.
Yeah. And the point is there's so much more. So tell our listeners, what are the parameters for the challenge?
Well, we're just looking for something we can hopefully put on the air, maybe 20, 25 lines. You can write about a baseball player. You can write about a baseball team. You can write about how you hate baseball. You can even write about the Yankees.
Marianne Moore, a big baseball fan, did that.
She wrote about the Yankees?
Mm. Give us a stanza. I think Jim and I can take it. Go ahead.
Okay. Assign Yogi Berra to Cape Canaveral. He could handle any missile. He is no feather. Strike. Strike two. Fouled back. A blur. It's gone. You would infer that the bat had eyes. He put the wood to that one.
Yogi Berra is a terrific poet. But I have one image from Robert Pinsky that maybe will inspire somebody. This is from the end of Television. Thank you. I watched live Jackie Robinson stealing home. The image, oh, strung shell, enduring fleeter than light, like these words we remember in, they too winged at the helmet and ankles.
Ooh.
Great Dodger.
Okay, listeners, you are challenged. I'm not sure about the writing about the Yankees part, but everything else goes. The deadline for your baseball poems is a week from today, which is next Thursday, June 12th. Please visit our website to send in your submissions. And for the rules of engagement, it's here-now.org. That's here-now.org. And because of a specific request from one of our listeners, mail them in as well. 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Just send it to Here and Now Baseball Poems. Again, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Again, the deadline, Thursday, June 12th. It'll take some time for us to read your work, and then we'll contact a few of you to talk about your poems. Okay, you guys, thanks so much.
Take me out to the ballgame, Robin.
Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack.
Here Now's roving poets Molly Sicardo and Jim Burley.
And baseball has been in the news more than usual these past 2 days as Chicago Cubs fans, league officials, and columnists try to make sense of the disturbing story involving home run king Sammy Sosa, who was caught Tuesday night using a corked bat in a game. Well, we've got one more baseball poem. It's about the controversy, penned by Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's sports show Only a Game, a poem called Sosa's Bat.
Sammy Sosa was a hero, no doubt about that. He whacked out home runs by the bushel with his mighty bat. And all throughout the land, from coast to coast and in between, the balls that Sammy hammered left the park and were not seen again, except by kids who picked them up as worthy treasure. For Sammy was a hero, by whatever means you measure. And then one day our Sammy, while proceeding to the plate, picked up the bat he says he likes to practice with to sate the fans of batting practice who all cheer his mighty clouts. And that bat was, well, not quite right, so it inspires doubts. For Sammy's bat, which he used in a game, was filled with cork. And now the former hero, Sammy Sosa, is a dork.
Bill Littlefield hosts NPR's sports show, Only a Game. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Many thanks and farewell to intern Marisa Francini. I'm Bill Delaney. Get into your radio and join us again here and now. When the mighty case struck out.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.